That's a different fun. Okay, so, well, it's a pleasure to be able to talk to you today. This is a little different. This is going to be somewhat less of a review talk than what some of the things we usually have in the Blackboard lunch. But it's kind of a pleasure for me to be able to tell you about what I think is some of the pretty exciting work that we've been doing here at the ITP and give you some idea of some of the kinds of things that happen in condensed matter theory here. The hopefully sexy title notwithstanding, this is not the one thing I want to start from the outset and tell you is this is not a talk about the high TC mechanism. It's a talk on high TC phenomenology, as such, any questions about the mechanism are completely outlawed. I will refuse to answer them. And apparently have no opinion. Okay, so let's jump into it. I want to start by giving you some introduction to what I think are some of the interesting phenomena in high TC. I have to give you a tiny bit of background about the materials. This is definitely a theory talk, and given the time constraints, I'm going to have to be kind of short with a lot of things. But stop me if I lose you. So the high TC materials are all of them basically quasi-two-dimensional compounds composed. Probably the most important ingredient in them are copper oxide layers. These you can think of as just a square lattice of copper atoms with oxygen atoms sitting on the bonds. Between these layers are various other atoms, depending on the material, which we think of as acting as charge reservoirs. These can either donate electrons or more commonly remove electrons from the plane, so we think of that as adding holes. There's a little bit of terminology. We say one of these things is undoped if on average there's one electron per copper site on these copper oxide layers. More often than not, and certainly the ones that are superconducting, are doped, by which we mean that we've added some, usually holes, to these layers so that there's less than one electron per site on average. There's a huge variety of these materials, and I'm certainly oversimplifying there. And there's a huge variety of interesting phenomena. They've been pretty well studied over the last N years. However, there's a remarkable amount of universality in the phenomena that you see. And what I'd like, the way I'd like to illustrate it is with a sort of very schematic phase diagram as a function of temperature and doping, actually hole doping. So X will be the concentration of holes added per site, fraction of holes added per site in each copper oxide layer. Around X equals 0 is the undoped material with one electron per site. I want to focus on three different phenomena in roughly historical order that have been of particular interest in the high TCs. The first, I think probably one of the first and heavily studied aspects of these compounds occurs in the undoped materials, which are antiferromagnetic insulators. These are some of the best quantum spin one-half insulators, insulating antiferromagnets that are known, and they really were a testing ground for a lot of theoretical ideas about quantum antiferromagnets. A huge amount of experimental and theoretical effort went into understanding the properties of the antiferromagnets. Obviously, another element of these things, which is very important, is that when you dope them above some critical doping, they go superconducting. This X sees between a tenth and a 10% and 20%. At low temperatures, you get a superconducting state. What's perhaps more interesting from the theoretical point of view is that this is actually an unconventional superconductor. It's what we call a D-wave superconductor. What does that mean? Well, I have to tell you, remind you what a superconductor is. So the things that carry charge around in condensed matter systems are electrons, usually. In a superconductor, this is for the benefit of the duality people, probably, electrons are spin 1/2 fermions. And in a... You might have forgotten. So in a superconductor, what happens is that actually electrons, typically with opposite spin, will bind together, form a bound state, spin singlet bound state. This bound state is a boson, a spinless boson, and these bosons, just as rubidium atoms in an atomic trap, can bose condense at low temperatures. When you have this bose condensation, you have a charged superfluid, and that's a superconductor. The unique thing about the high TC superconductors, in contrast to low temperature superconductors, is that this bound state is actually a bound state of finite angular momentum. It's actually a bound state with in the D wave channel. And that has a lot of interesting physical consequences. It's M equals plus or minus 2. So we're going to talk about the two-dimensional. That has a lot of... can people see the bottom here? I'm just wondering. Is there anyone who can't see the bottom? Tell me. No? Okay, so I'll draw a little down there. Oh, yeah, these are spin zero. Yeah. There are triplet superconductors, but these are not. The ITCs are all singlet superconductors. So what is this? This has many consequences, and is, I think, now probably universally agreed that this is the case. But one of the most important ones is that a D-wave wave function, so if you look at the wave function of the relative coordinate, it necessarily has zeros in it. In particular, if we look, say, at the Fourier transform of that pair wave function, it has zeros along lines like this in momentum space. And what that means is that if you look at electrons with momentum along these lines, they're actually not bound. So unlike a conventional S-wave superconductor where the pair wave function is non-vanishing everywhere in momentum space, here there are always some unbound quasi-particles. And that's a very important distinction of a D-wave superconductor. They're extra low-lying, low-energy degrees of freedom in a D-wave superconductor. And I'll come back to that and tell you a bit how we describe it as we go on. So in a S-wave superconductor, the pairs are in an angular momentum zero state. So the pair wave function doesn't vanish anywhere. So basically all the electrons are paired into Cooper pairs. And that's not true in a D-wave. I'm speaking kind of loosely, and maybe I definitely will expound upon that a little later, but sorry. Yeah, there are low energy pairs which are broken by very small fields, for instance. Oh, sorry, this is momentum space. This would be kx and ky. So the point is this pair wave function is a function of angle. It goes like cosine squared minus sine squared theta.
The fact that the pairing energy is zero, does that mean that the pairing energy is zero?
It does for those directions in momentum space.
But that requires an extra something. I mean, that's not conceptually separate. Conceptually, it's separate, no? The amplitude...
Well, there's an overall energy scale that just multiplies the amplitude of this pair wave function. But if the pair wave function itself vanishes, then this energy also vanishes. That's the distinction between the pair field and the pair potential.
The wave function having nodes doesn't mean it's zero energy.
Right, it follows from some theory.
It does, and I'm going to explain that. This is meant to just be some survey here.
Excuse me. But yeah. When you say low energy degrees of freedom from this picture, that means they have a one-dimensional dispersion relation?
They actually don't have a one-dimensional dispersion relation, but I will... So the gap, this pair wave function, is zero along these lines, but increases smoothly away from them. And you have to take that into account. And I'll tell you how one does that.
Vanishes on this line.
Exactly. Yeah.
If the gap vanishes, why does the super
Well, that's a... There's different definitions of a superconductor. I mean, it's a, this is still a state which would have a Meissner effect, for instance.
But what the gap vanishes, the question of how rapidly it vanishes?
No, it's a separate question. The essence of superconductivity really is the condensation of pairs.
No, there is a microscopic order parameter.
Absolutely, there is. And, yeah.
In a type 2 superconductor, where you have magnetic field, the gas vanishes at the center of every vortex, but it's certainly a superconductor.
Yeah.
Right, unless the vortices are
unless
when you're above HC2, then...
So here, in some sense, this is, if the bears a small enough measure in the momentum space, that measures zero.
Well, the important thing is that there's a broken charge conservation symmetry, and that's still true here. So there is a non-zero order parameter, and there's a phase associated with that. But I'll get to that.
Let's say you have a spin M superconductor for M goes to infinity. Doesn't that wipe out superconductivity?
I'll have to leave that to you guys. No doubt that would come out of string theory. I'll say quite a bit more about this, so let's get beyond there.
How well
is the two-dimensionality is not really crucial here. Of course, these are quasi-two-dimensional. You can ask about... there's always some coupling between electrons in different layers. But for the purposes of this talk, let's imagine that it really is perfectly two-dimensional. And one can certainly build that into the phenomenology. In a quasi-two-dimensional D-wave superconductor, you have lines of nodes as you move in momentum space along the Z-axis, rather than just these. So these would extend out into sheets, if you like. Okay. So I want to indicate a third feature on this phase diagram. I would indicate that by a dotted line. Call this T star of X. This is the critical temperature. Below this line, there's been a lot of recent experimental effort in identifying and understanding the properties of what we call the pseudo-gap region. What does that mean? Well, what one sees is that if you look at temperatures that are above TC but less than T star, the system is not superconducting. But nevertheless, pardon?
Define T star.
It's that line.
Oh, it's that line. Define through that line.
Yes. That's how you, I'm telling you now how you define T star. And of course, it's defined in some rough way. But below this temperature T star, in a large number of different experiments, one sees the electrons actually acting as though they were already paired up, even though there's no macroscopic order parameter. So within this region, there appears to be pairing without condensation. Let me just say pairing without condensation. Okay. Now, that for people in the BEC program, that should be probably nothing special. Your bosons are atoms, which don't ionize until you get up to temperatures of electron volts. And they don't condense until you get down to temperatures of hundreds of nanokelvin. So certainly in those systems, you have a much bigger gap between T star and TC than we have here. However, in the context of superconductors, this is pretty unusual. When you think of the low-temperature superconductors, which are pretty well described by the BCS mean field theory, where pairing and phase coherence set in at the same temperature, which is just the mean field TC. So in a more general sense, the way I'd like you to think about this is that in this region, one has really a sort of local order parameter with some amplitude. So in general, one can write this thing as an amplitude and a phase. And the amplitude is appreciable in this region, but there are strong phase fluctuations. if you were at some, say, temperature over here above the superconducting phase, you would say that this phase is fluctuating due to thermal effects. There are strong thermal fluctuations of the phase that destroy the long-range order of this pair field. I should, if you like, define this thing at some local expectation value of electron operators. However, I can, from this phase diagram, follow this down to a doping below XC. And then apparently I can go all the way to zero temperature and still have no superconductivity. But we're below the pseudogap line, so it appears that the electrons are paired. If I want to understand this, and that's going to be the goal here, is to understand this region, this mystery phase, I have to understand how superconductivity can be destroyed not by thermal fluctuations of the phase, but by quantum fluctuations of the phase.
May I ask you, but usually it's clear that here is there is very strong localization, and it's an explanation why there is a gap. Because when you have low concentration, or doping concentration, you have very severe energy term is very small, and you have very severe localization. So you have
okay, and I will answer that question in two ways. One is I really want to think, basically in this talk, I would like to talk about an ideal pure limit in which we have no impurities in the sample. So I don't want to talk about localization in the Anderson sense. However, in another sense, what you're saying is, and I will explain that in a moment, is really just a sort of conjugate way of saying that there are strong phase fluctuations. The meaning of strong phase fluctuations is very much the same as saying that there's a strong localization of the electron density. So let me, that in fact is a point I want to make pretty soon. So.
Would you say what's just an example of an experiment, evidence for
that? There are lots. Very nice experiments are electron photo emission, where you try and kick out an electron, and in doing so you can measure the spectral function of a single electron, not a pair. So you can ask how many unbound electrons are there, and you can see a dramatic reduction of that as you pass through this line, and you can see the D-wave anisotropy in the gap that way by resolving the momentum dependence, for instance. Okay? All right. Let me start here. So that's introduction. So this is our goal, to understand this quantum disordered version of the D-wave state. To do that, we better understand the D-wave first. So I'm going to give you a lightning introduction to how to model the D-wave quasiparticles. As I said, the crucial ingredient is that you have, in momentum space, a pair wave function that vanishes along sets of nodes. So it's going to be convenient to take... Sorry, was there a question? No? That just hurts me. It's going to be convenient to take axes that go along these lines of nodes in momentum space. Okay. Since we're talking about a condensed matter system of electrons, these are fermions, as I stressed, and at low energies, all their properties are dominated by the physics at the Fermi surface. The states below the Fermi surface are all occupied, and above it are unoccupied. Well, in these materials, it doesn't really matter that much for my purposes, but the Fermi surface looks actually something like this, the states in here being occupied and those unoccupied. As I stressed earlier, the pair wave function is actually non-vanishing away from these lines, and all these states will actually be gapped out due to the presence of this pair field. They'll be bound. What we want to focus on is the behavior near these, the points where these nodes in the pair wave function intersect the Fermi surface. These are four points in momentum space. So it's near these points in momentum space that all the interesting low energy physics goes on. So let me call this some wave vector K1 here, and this some other wave vector K2. Near this wave vector, for instance, the gap function is a function of wave vector. It'll be zero for Q equal to zero. There'll be an overall phase, and then there'll be some linear coefficient, which has the dimensions of a velocity, since this thing has a dimension of energy. Okay. Telling how it varies away from there. And something similar happens near these other points. Okay. all one has to do is plug this in to a Hamiltonian, allowing this pair field in general to couple to C up, C down, and C up dagger, C down dagger. We just want to focus on the degrees of freedom near these four points. I could do that by defining, this is the most technical thing that we'll have here, but I sort of want to do it to ease things later, defining four different electron operators in these four regions of momentum space. Any experts in the audience will recognize that these things are very closely related to the Nambu-Goldstone spinner for superconductivity. So, oh, sorry, Nambu-Gorkov, Nambu-Goldstone. Where did I get that? The reason is that this pair field is an anomalous object and connects particles and holes. And so in order to write something that looks non-anomalous, I have to do that. So this is really a technicality, but I'd still like to tell you something correct. If you do that, then just focus on the momentum near here, what can actually go back to real space and write a continuum Lagrangian. And it takes a pretty simple form. There's a usual, this is just a PQ dot term in the Lagrangian. This is a term linear in the momentum normal to the Fermi surface, just coming from the dispersion of the electrons. Then there's something a little more complicated. This is coming from the variation of the pair wave function parallel to the Fermi surface. I've introduced a Pauli matrix tau, which connects particles and holes, or equivalently goes across the Fermi surface.
So okay. Psi 1 is now a two-component spinner made of.
Yeah, Psi 1 contains these fields, and Psi 2 contains these fields. Okay. All right. So if I were to set, for instance, phi equal to 0, this ought to look reasonably familiar to some of the field theorists in the audience. This is actually just one form of the Dirac equation in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And for that reason, we'll often call these points in momentum space two-dimensional Dirac points. And indeed, the quasi-particle dispersion around these points is relativistic.
Can you explain how plus or minus again?
Right.
The two points.
Yeah, so you notice I defined a dagger down here and a non-dagger up here. So this tau plus term is actually a term connecting electron operators here and here, and so is tau minus.
And why
is that? Because the pair wave function is a zero-momentum object. So if I want to build something that has zero momentum, I can look at a C of K, C of minus K. Mm-hmm. So it goes across.
So 1 and 2 are just connected in this quasi-particle Hamiltonian?
Yeah, because the thing is diagonal in momentum space.
Yeah.
Okay, it's translationally invariant.
Is the constant?
Sorry?
E to the I phi, is that a constant?
Okay, we're going to want to consider cases where phi varies, because we're going to look at quantum fluctuations. In the mean field limit, it's a constant, and then this follows. Okay.
You can get rid of it if it's a constant.
Exactly. Of course, everything should be invariant under that. And that's the disadvantage of what we have here, because we don't manifestly see the invariance of this thing under a constant phase shift. And actually, that's a disadvantage of this formalism, as I have it so far. We're really covering up some very beautiful property of the D-wave state. And that property is actually a separation of charge and spin. Alternatively, another way to be driven to look at this feature is that we were going to want to consider fluctuations in this phase phi. But this is going to be technically very difficult to do since we have the exponential sitting here in our Lagrangian. What we'd like to do is get rid of it, gauge it away. The physics behind that is that in the D-wave superconductor, we've broken the charge conservation symmetry. And so charge isn't really a good quantum number. And that's the reason we're allowed to mix particles and holes. But we want to look at a state which is not a superconductor, which is an insulator, and charge better be a good quantum number again. If we want to work with objects that have uncertain charge, it's going to be very difficult. We want to work with objects that are neutral. In fact, we can do that by defining a new field, psi, which is a sort of gauge transform of the original field, capital psi. Okay. So remember that the electrons, these psi fields, have charge E, and the Cooper pairs have charge 2E. So by taking half of the Cooper pair phase, we get something which is actually neutral. Okay. You tell me. So at this point, we're just trying to derive a general model which will cover both.
Okay.
Depending on whether this phase is fluctuating or not. Okay.
If it's fluctuating, then you assume.
Exactly. Okay. So this is a neutral field, and it creates quanta that are not charged. They do, however, carry spin because this thing was built out of electrons, and all we've done is multiply it by a phase that doesn't know anything about the spin. So these are spinful neutral particles. You could use them equally well in the D-wave superconductor, or we will use them outside the D-wave superconducting state. We will call them nodons because they're descended from the quasiparticles coming from the nodes, and we like to have some sexy name. The nice thing about this is this really embodies a really beautiful, I think, sort of spin charge separation. In particular, the charge is carried entirely by this phase phi, whereas spin is carried entirely by this field psi. The Cooper pairs are singlets, so they don't have any spin. Of course, both things can carry, for instance, energy and momentum, current. Okay. If you make this change of variables, we'll be in a much better position to try and incorporate phase fluctuations, because what this thing will do, having converted psi into a neutral field, we can't have these exponentials multiplying it. It will gauge them away. And I'm going to write for you what happens if you make this transformation. What happens is it cancels off these phase factors, and then you'll get some derivatives of the phase in the process of doing that. Okay, so this part of the Lagrangian first, I'll just call the free Lagrangian for these nodons. It's very similar to what we had already, except that phase has been rotated to zero everywhere. And then there will be an interaction term, which involves gradients of the phase coupled to some bilinears of these fermions, which you can think of as the currents associated with these nodal quasiparticles. And at this point, it's convenient so that we can calculate other things as we go along to introduce an external vector potential. For instance, we can use this to try and dope the system to put on an overall chemical potential. Sorry? So I haven't specified that at this point, and I'm going to do that instead via duality, which is the next thing coming up. So, indeed, one has to specify a kinetic term for phi, but that I haven't specified that at this point. So this is kind of a nice two-fluid description. There's some dynamics for the phi, which I'll get to, and there's dynamics for these nodons, and they're coupled via a current-current interaction. Okay, so we've done one and two. Yeah, these things carry all the spin in the superconductor. You could do this equally well just in. The Cooper pairs are singlets, but the quasiparticles are not. Well, in fact, one does need to have the D wave to have this continuum form for the quasiparticles here, because there wouldn't be any gapless spinful excitations in an S wave superconductor.
Yeah, but if it has a gap, you would still have the spin separation.
There is a separation in an S wave superconductor as well, certainly. And it has much more dramatic effects in the D wave. Okay. So now we want to turn to try and quantum disorder the superconductor. It sounds like a very exotic thing to do, incorporating these phase fluctuations, but I want to explain to you that it's not so exotic via a simple example. And that's a quantum disordered superfluid, for instance, helium-4. Now you might ask, how can I turn helium-4, which we all know is a superfluid at zero temperature and ambient pressure, hint, into a non-superfluid phase? You can do that by applying pressure. The helium atoms have some Leonard Jones-like interaction, and as you apply pressure, let's say from one atmosphere, they'll ultimately crystallize at zero temperature. And they have a phase diagram. I guess it looks something like this. There's the superfluid state, the normal liquid, higher temperatures, and then a crystal. Okay, this is very unexotic. Lots of things crystallize as a function of pressure. As you go at zero temperature, from low pressure to high pressure, you have a quantum phase transition between a superfluid state and a non-superfluid state. In what sense does this have anything to do with phase fluctuation? It will be first order. In fact, this line is first order, numerically. Not necessarily in two dimensions, but it is certainly at low temperatures, it's first order. Okay, so that's certainly true. I'm not worrying about the order of the phase transition. We'd like to understand, though, in what sense is this crystalline phase a quantum disordered counterpart to the superfluid? And the way to understand that is really via the uncertainty principle. Just like position and momentum in ordinary quantum mechanics, the number and phase are canonically conjugate variables. So in the superfluid phase, what we've done is we've Bose-condensed all these helium atoms into one macroscopic state, which is extended across the entire sample. So the density is as spread out as it can be. It's as uncertain as it can be. But the phase is very certain because everything's in one state. In the crystal, it's really the opposite situation, where you're putting every boson, basically, into a different site of the lattice. So the number of particles in any given state, given place, is very sharp. Consequently, the uncertainty relation is telling you that the phase is extremely wildly fluctuating. You can think of that in another sense as just that I have to put all the bosons in different wave functions to accommodate a crystal. The nice thing about being in two dimensions is that there's a very beautiful mathematical framework for understanding this and actually calculating things, and that's duality. To see that, what we want to think of is compare the quanta of density, which are just our original bosons. So for the superconductor, these are Cooper pairs with charge plus or minus 2e. With the quantum of, the closest thing we can get to a quanta of phase, and that's a vortex. So that's a point defect, and that's crucial, around which the phase winds by a multiple of 2 pi. So the crucial thing is that in two dimensions, both the original particles and their vortices are point objects. And in a quantum mechanical theory, we can elevate these vortices to quantum point particles. What duality does for you is it interchange the bosons and the vortices. Through this duality, one can understand that the superfluid is a state in which one condenses the bosons. The crystal is a state in which one condenses the vortices. To carry that out, one wants to start with an operator, the pair field, that creates Cooper pairs at some amplitude times a phase, and trade that for a different operator, a new complex field with another amplitude and a phase that creates vortices.
Okay, but the interaction between bosons and between vortices are quite different, no?
Absolutely. So that's where another element comes into into account. And what's missing, if you just included this degree of freedom, it wouldn't be sufficient. You have to tie. The fact is, the vortex has this phase winding around it, and that phase winding, phase gradients are connected to currents. So you have to enforce that connection. Another way of saying that is you have to enforce charge conservation. And that's done by introducing, turns out, another field whose curl is the total 3 current. This is a sort of fictitious gauge field. which binds the currents to the vortices, if you like. Another way of saying it is that this saying that J is a curl of A requires that the divergence of J is zero. Let's see, actually I want to go over to the right. Okay. So there's a very precise sequence of mathematical steps that you can do to carry out this duality, and this is not the place to actually do that. I'll just quote for you. I hope I've motivated this change of variables, if you like, and I'll quote for you what the results are. Instead of giving you a kinetic term for these phase fluctuations, I'm going to give you a kinetic terms instead for the dual variables, this field that creates vortices and this fictitious gauge field. Okay. And that will add to this Lagrangian some other terms. This current is going to have to be replaced by some other expression in the dual theory, so I'll say what that is. What one finds is there's a pretty conventional looking kinetic term for this complex phi field. And an electromagnetic Lagrangian for the fictitious electric and magnetic fields for this corresponding to that gauge field A. Can people see this across the other side? I hope so. I'd like to keep this up here. And then this interaction term will be replaced by a different coupling. To the gauge field plus the external current of these nodons. Okay, part of this is kinetic energy and part of this is potential energy, really. One can think of the same would have been true if we went back to the phi variables. One of them is related to the compressibility and one is related to the superfluid density in that sense. I'm writing everything in a 2 plus 1 dimension, so some of those are time derivatives. Okay. Now, in fact, this is a very familiar form. In particular, if we took the time to continue to imaginary time, this could be exactly the form of a classical 3D Ginzburg-Landau theory, which would describe a classical three-dimensional superconductor. So phi would be the classical order parameter, and A would be the internal gauge field, so that these would be the internal electric, the different components of the internal magnetic field. What's playing the role of an external field is this external gauge field and the nodon current. Okay, so this will be a very, very useful analogy since we know a lot about the properties of classical Ginzburg-Landau theories. And one thing in particular will be useful is the fact that A0, which is the chemical potential for bosons, it's twice the chemical potential for holes, since there are two holes in a Cooper pair. That's analogous to the external magnetic field applied to this Ginzburg-Landau model. What does that do? Well, when you apply an external magnetic field, it tries to put in an internal magnetic field. But the internal magnetic field, which I've already erased, probably. No, here it is. Internal magnetic field is related to the total charge in the system. So the internal magnetic field, B, is actually related to the actual doping, X. Okay.
Now, why is the Lagrangian second derivative in time, is that obvious? Well, you can make this classical.
Yeah, right, it is second derivative in time. And really, it's because I'm writing this for the undoped system, which has a, this is definitely an expert remark, but it has a particle hole symmetry. That's why it's convenient to perform this duality around the undoped.
I see. Otherwise, you won't have this constant.
No, and in fact, so we'll need to understand what happens as you dope the system, the behavior changes. Okay. So now we're in a position to try and use this thing and understand some properties of these different quantum disordered phases. So the first thing I want to do is look at the simplest case, which would be a hypothetical nodal liquid quantum disordered phase at zero doping, it will turn out to be a rather interesting kind of quantum liquid, since its underlying degrees of freedom are these nodons. I'd like to call it a nodal liquid. That's rather easy to understand, that limit, though. So we have zero external field, and we want to be, remember, our goal was to quantum disorder the superconductor. We want to condense the vortices. This field phi is a vortex field, so we want to condense it. So to describe this phase, what we should do is set this expectation value non-zero. Okay. In that case, we can effectively replace the Ginsburg-Landau model just by, I guess there's some mu here. This amplitude squared acts as a mass for this fictitious gauge field. So this is the usual Anderson-Higgs mechanism, I think we say in... Absolutely.
What you can tell about that, why in this case you think that phase fluctuation play any role? I don't understand.
I will certainly in half a second tell you how you see that this is indeed a dielectric. Another way to say it is, again, this coming back to the comment that you made earlier, at half filling we know very well that these systems are mod insulators in which the charge is very localized. The uncertainty relation is telling us that another way to view that is that the phase is fluctuating very wildly. It's simply that my description perhaps is rather orthogonal to the way one often looks at these things. But we'll see that the physical consequences are the same. There's certainly some other good objections that you're making, and we'll probably other ones I hope some people come up with in a moment, or I'll bring them up myself. So we've derived a mass for this gauge field, and now we can just integrate it out to try and get an effective Lagrangian for these nodal quasiparticles and the external gauge field. What do you get? Well, there's the free piece, which goes along for a ride, for the ride. Then there are a number of other terms. One thing that you get is a conventional electromagnetic Lagrangian for the physical electromagnetic field. So this is indeed describing the properties of a dielectric. It's giving you the dielectric response. But there's more than just that response. You'll also find terms in which this physical gauge field is coupled to a current. It turns out that this current I mu, sort of roughly, I'm being a little bit rough here, related to two derivatives of this nodon current defined there. It's actually the transverse piece of that, which you might have guessed. And then in addition to that, there are some quadratic interactions of these currents that you generate. Okay. This term, these are interactions between the nodons generated by these phase fluctuations. The nice thing, however, about these Dirac particles is that they have a very small density of states. And furthermore, these are high derivative interactions. These interactions are very strongly irrelevant interactions. And in order to understand the low energy properties of this phase, we can actually ignore them. So rather than cross it out, I'm going to just erase it, freeze the board up. Now we're in a position. Yeah, I'm using different kappas everywhere to avoid notational overload. Yeah, so is the magnetic permeability. Both are renormalized. Okay, so there are a number of simple properties we can understand. The first is that this is really describing an insulator, an electrical insulator.
I missed why there's a Laplacian in front of the
Well, so that you can see very just from here, integrate by parts and put a derivative on there if you want.
Oh, you mean you integrate our little a?
Yeah, little a.
Okay.
All right. So the first consequence is that this nodal liquid is insulating. There's a dielectric response coming from the insulating, if you like, frozen localized Cooper pairs. And there's a small extra response coming from this term, some extra response coming from these nodal particles. But remember, they're neutral. And they actually don't respond very strongly to the applied electromagnetic field. And in fact, this is still an insulator. The interesting thing, though, is that there are very interesting spin properties, spin physics here. For instance, there's a magnetic susceptibility, which is power law at low temperatures. So spin can be carried by these nodal quasiparticles, as can energy. Okay. There are a lot of other details which I'd like to pass over since...
May I emphasize the point I'm with you on this? I mean, we've killed the superconductivity, but the quasiparticles, which were there because of the supermagnetic to begin with, are still surviving.
Bigger chalk.
Well, from the usual condensed theory is unusual in the sense that this type of theory actually starts to describe the dielectric starting from a superconducting viewpoint.
Absolutely.
This is very.
But our goal is really to get into the pseudo gap region, and I'll try and move towards that a little bit more as we.
Recover the anti-magnetic phase.
If it were an X-ray superconductor, we would have no low energy field left.
So the important physics you've shown us so far is that there are these gapless fermion degrees of freedom,
right.
Gapless quantum particles.
And that they survive even in the quantum disordered state.
It's for excitations, but not for ground state. Let me tell you, it's a completely different thing.
Well, this is not a state with anti-ferromagnetic long range order at this point.
Excitations. If a pair is a boson.
Yeah, I understand. These
that's right. And I want to ask you in general question. We have two things we immediately should answer. First, we have two-dimensional superfluidity. When phase, you know, it's oscillator, it's divergency in phase correlations at the same
at finite temperature. We're talking about zero temperature here.
No, but nevertheless, we have a very nice superfluidity.
Absolutely.
We have no long-range order, but we have topological order.
Absolutely.
Yes. From another side, in helium-3, we have the situation when it's a triplet, but nevertheless, we have a line. Of such a singularity, so we have no problems. At temperature zero and finite temperature, we have no problems. What's why we, in that case, we have no situation with destroying superfluidity?
Oh, I'm not saying that you have to destroy superfluidity. Clearly, there is a D-wave.
Zero, you are discussing. Why there is no... in that case, there is no destruction.
You say helium 3, where you put it under pressure, it goes into a solid phase. So it's possible to have.
I'm not trying to argue that.
The transition is completely different things. It's a transition first order, transition is completely different things.
I'm not discussing the transition, and I'm also not arguing that you have to, that you can't have a superconductor. Certainly you can. These are just different phases of this model.
You wrote x equals 0 out there, but presumably you mean x about the antiferromagnetic.
No, I don't, actually. What I'm... So what we're...
In this picture, how does the antiferromagnetic...
Very good, yes. So this is a question I was hoping people would ask. I mean, we're working step by step. It's certainly possible to imagine, within this model, one can have a D-wave superconductor at half filling. You don't have that in the cuprates. But we can certainly write down a model. I'm 100% confident that I can give you a model which will go superconducting at half filling. It's just that the physical systems are not there. What we'd like to do is start adding more and more physics to get into a model which captures all the phenomenology. It's simplest to work near half filling exactly because of these problems with the linear time derivatives and business that you were bringing up.
The newest question, I think, at the risk of putting words in your mouth and in Matthew's mouth, if I take this theory seriously, then I should be able to apply it to helium-3 and describe the solids to with the solid transition, where the solid would be some old version of industrial magnetism. Around this, because I think the A phase has this nodal point, and I do have the.
I'm not trying to describe any triplet pairing or
something. No, this would be having some novel solid phase of helium-3 with, a remnant of the quasi-particle node. It probably doesn't exist there. This phase won't even start thinking about it in that context.
If you have very strong first-order transitions, then there's no reason to get into this phase, which is closely connected to the superfluid phase.
Something that obviously is why you needed the duality step. I mean, you could have written down Lorenz Jenkins theory directly in the original field phi, and it would have so far the same terminology.
One could have done that. It would have been much more difficult to condense the vortices in this. That would have been a very convenient formalism for studying the D-wave state, but much less so for the non-superconducting state.
Well, it's a different Lagrangian, right? I mean, it's really a different physics. So far, we have the same physics.
No, because it's the same Lagrangian, except similar physics, written in terms of dual variables.
In the dual variables, this phase is the ordered state.
You say it's the same, you say it's really a lot of...
Well, he's writing down an effective Lagrangian. He can assume that it has duality.
Both of them have two phases. It's a more convenient variables to describe this phase because this is the order. This phase is the ordered phase in these variables. It would be a quantum disordered phase in the other variables.
Right, I guess I'm wondering, and is there really an identity between these two field theories?
He doesn't have a theory. He's writing down an effective theory. So he can say, describe the phase instead of using the original variables, or write it down in terms of dual variables, and then if you want the theory of the other variables, it's a dual existence. Same universality.
Same universality.
You don't have a fundamental theory and then prove duality.
No, it's just phenomenal. I mean, we're not saying that anything is self-dual. We're just using it as a change of variables, if you want.
And using dual variables to construct an
effect. Is this phase, is it solid or liquid or anything? I mean, is it transitional?
Another very good question. Good. That's very closely related to Tony's question, in fact, and that's the reason that I've presented this part so far as in the undoped case. If you have this quantum disordered phase at half filling, it's commensurate with the underlying lattice, and there are no additional translational symmetry to break. That's the special choice that has been made here. If we dope this thing away from half filling, this phase will indeed break translational symmetry, and there will be some. Depending whether I can squeeze it in, I will certainly tell you. is that answering?
I don't know whether my question is relevant.
No, go ahead.
The main part, you mentioned duality in two-dimensional superfluid.
Yeah.
Actually, I can't agree with you because this duality exists in one dimension. You see, when you deal with a quantum system,
there are different dualities. I understand.
Actually, if the transition from superfluid to crystal is concerned, actually, this transition is a zero-point phase transition. And if you deal with a quantum system,
in one dimension, those theories are self-dual. In two dimensions, they're not self-dual. One has a gauge field in one description and not in the other.
My point is, you should add one more dimension. So actually, a quantum two-dimensional system. Is 2 plus 1.
Oh, I'm doing it all in 2 plus 1 dimensions here.
And so, you see, in 2 dimensions, vortex is a classical object.
This is 2 plus 1 dimensions.
There are two special dimensions.
Yeah.
one. I cannot agree that a crystal is a crystal of vortices. When you have two-dimensional crystallized vortices, you just have what is known as array, vortex array, and this state is superfluid.
This is we're crystallizing the Cooper pairs, not the vortices.
That's a the ongoing.
Yeah. Oh boy, let's see. So how long can I go at this point? Do you want to? I don't want to make this drag on too long. Let's. Okay, so I want to get to two other elements that have been left out, and I'll try and do it as quickly as possible. So one thing which certainly many of you have realized is that the undoped system, I drew the phase diagram for you earlier, is an antiferromagnet, and this thing is not an antiferromagnet. Okay, so if one, we're trying to do phenomenology, I'm not trying to be predictive in that sense, but we can put the antiferromagnetism back in. What one needs to do, one way of doing it, is to include explicitly the fluctuations of the nail vector, the order parameter for the antiferromagnetism. And that would also have some Ginsburg-Landau sort of form. But the important thing here is that this the neutrons carry spin, and the antiferromagnet carries spin also. So these two things can couple very strongly to each other. And the coupling is an interesting one. Don't worry about all the matrices in there. The physics of this is that, at least for the undoped system, the nail vector is pi pi, which is very close to the distance between two opposite nodes. So it's possible to gain momentum pi from scattering a spin wave in the antiferromagnet and move one of these nodons from one side of the Fermi surface to the other. Okay. So if we want to model the antiferromagnet, one thing you can do is say that this V has a Ginsburg-Landau form. You might at first glance just take this coefficient R less than 0. Then you have the inverted Mexican hat. You get an expectation value for N. Then you might say, oh, we're getting some really weird phase. We've got antiferromagnetism, but also these fermions floating around. But actually, that's not so true, because once you have a non-zero N, you have an additional quadratic term in the Lagrangian for the nodons. And that actually acts as a Dirac mass. So the weakly doped antiferromagnet, or the undoped antiferromagnet, actually will give a gap to these fermionic quasiparticles, and there no longer is any strange low-energy physics that you wouldn't have wanted to have in the antiferromagnet. That's all very consistent. An interesting thing is that suppose you assume that R was bigger than 0. Well, then naively you would say, well, there's no inverted Mexican hat potential. The nail vector should be 0. We would have a non-antiferromagnetic state. Okay. But that's not necessarily true if this coupling constant is not small. In particular, you can gain, if you like, condensation energy from these Dirac particles. In the absence of this interaction, if the nail vector is 0, they have some relativistic dispersion, energy versus momentum. And they're fermions, so you've filled up these negative energy states and left these empty. Boy, there was a colored... There it is. If we get a gap to the spectrum, what will happen is we'll pick up, if you assume there was some antiferromagnetic order, we'd raise these states up, but those are unoccupied, doesn't change the energy. We'd lower these states, you'd actually lower the energy somewhat. There's some condensation energy to be gained from developing antiferromagnetic order. So actually, even if this coefficient is positive, but this is large enough, the system can go antiferromagnetic just from this interaction. And actually gives you some understanding of why antiferromagnetism might be very sensitive to doping. The point is, we assumed here that these Dirac points were separated by a vector very close to the nail vector, pi pi. As you dope the system, these Dirac points are going to move in. You're removing charge from the plane, so they'll move in. The whole Fermi surface likes to move in. You can actually see that because this is the charge density and it couples to one of these currents. As you do that, you destroy this perfect nesting, if you like, between this nail vector and this term, and you lose this condensation energy. So you can destroy antiferromagnetism in that way. So let me, having sort of mentioned that, let me just do a last thing and discuss what kind of phase diagram you'd predict from this model, now with the antiferromagnetism included. And the way to understand that is to go back to this Ginsburg-Landau theory, where we understand the phase diagram pretty well. So remember, we're thinking about a classical three-dimensional superconductor in an applied external field. We're going to increase the chemical potential from zero and ask what happens. Well, for small fields, we know very well, this is one of the defining characteristics of superconductivity, that the field doesn't penetrate as a Meissner effect. Well, the internal field is related to the doping. All this says is that as you first apply the field, no particles enter. Okay. But that's a consequence, really, of this thing being an insulator. There's a gap for charged excitation. However, as we increase it further, one of two things could happen. In a type 1 superconductor, as you increase the field, you get to some critical field, and all of a sudden the flux penetrates. You have a first-order transition, and you go into the normal state. Well, the normal state of the of our Ginsburg-Landau theory is the one where this dual order parameter is zero. Well, that means the vortices are not condensed. That actually describes a superfluid phase. So if this thing is in the range of parameters where it's a type 1 superconductor, you have a first order transition between the antiferromagnetic insulator and a superconductor. The alternative is a type 2 superconductor, in which case, as you increase the internal field, you first reach HC1. At that point, the field starts to penetrate in the form of a vortex lattice. Okay. But what is this vortex lattice back in the original variables? Well, we interchange vortices and Cooper pairs, so a vortex lattice is actually a crystal of Cooper pairs. It's in this scenario, what happens is as you crank up the chemical potential, you reach the gap, and Cooper pairs start to enter the sample in the form of a crystal. You have a Wigner crystal of Cooper pairs. Ultimately, you continue to increase the chemical potential. They get closer and closer. You eventually reach HC2, and the system goes normal. Normal is actually dual to the superconductor. So at that point, the system goes into the D-wave superconducting state. Now I've been doing that as a function of chemical potential. Normally, what you normally think of is what happens as a function of doping. And just let me conclude by drawing those, what the phase diagrams would look like in these two cases. So in the type 1 case, you have a first order transition. That's first order as a function of chemical potential. Remember, it's like working at constant magnetization or constant field in a magnet, way back in thermodynamics. If you have a first order transition, you actually get a coexistence region. And what one sort of generally expects is some curve, some phase diagram like this, where you have the antiferromagnetic state, some coexistence region, and the D-wave superconductor in the type 1 scenario. If the thing is type 2...
So why is antiferromagnetic...
why does it do this? Right, okay. So again, if we go back to the analogy here, as we increase mu, there's a finite mu at which it happens, you have a first order transition. And then the density jumps at that transition. So you go from having zero internal field to a finite internal field. Exactly, yeah. So in order to get any finite x, you actually just have coexistence between zero x and finite x. But then this is very complicated physics. You need to know how the domains form. That depends on long-range Coulomb interactions and such.
And T star is still up there somewhere.
T star is, this whole theory is entirely constructed assuming T star is infinite, essentially. So T star is added. This is only intended to describe physics below T star. The type 2 scenario is a bit more interesting. Once you reach HC1, you get this lattice of Cooper pairs. That's a sort of paired Wigner crystal. That's more details of this than probably necessary. one has some, this is the D wave, superconducting state, is the antiferromagnet. This nodal liquid actually coexists with the paired Wigner crystal for this intermediate range of doping. It turns out that the transition at HC2 is generically turned first order by fluctuations. That's been sort of well studied in classical Ginsburg-Landau theory. So there's some small coexistence region there. And most of what I've been telling you, this novel physics of the nodal liquid, is occurring in this regime. And with it come some very interesting charge physics, the physics of this paired Wigner crystal. This little thing would be a coexistence region between the.
You cannot decide at this point whether you have first little crystal or this little liquid.
Oh, this versus this scenario?
I don't understand location. You say the.
Oh, this is both. Remember, there's a sort of. One has really a kind of spin charge separation going on. And so in the charge sector, one has a crystal of these Cooper pairs that have been added. But on top of that are propagating these fermions, which carry the spin. Until we talked about doping, I was only talking about the spin physics. And
would you say that this is completely opposed to the SO5 theory then? Because he has anti-problematic.
The SO5 scenario would basically be this one.
We're stuck with your phase boundary. Lift it up on the top of the first order.
Yeah, no, they would put that there. That's. One needs to tune extra symmetries to achieve this kind of a result, but it's very close to this SO5 scenario.
Can you see from your Lagrangian some SO5?
No, sir. It's nothing. It's not necessary to have SO5 symmetry. I mean, there aren't that many ways that one can go between an antiferromagnet and a superconductor, and that's.
No. I don't know what moves out. You're doing phenomenology.
Well, no, but the way the superconductivity and the nail order parameters, the 3-2 components of the bidimensional effect, are coupled to these fermions.
Yeah. Right? One hasn't imposed any extra symmetry upon them.
Right.
You would need to impose that to bring this phase boundary up to here, for instance. Absolutely. Yeah. Alex?
What does the form agree from because they kept one range in production?
In fact, you know that Cooper pairs have to form a crystal at low doping because they're charged and have Coulomb interactions. The Abacos of, in fact, it's like a Wigner crystal. In fact, I've slept over a little detail here. I mean, in fact, if the Cooper pairs had the same interactions as vortices, at low densities, they would not crystallize. That's something that's outside of the mean field theory for that. For this classical Ginsburg-Landau theory. That's why one's not so familiar with it. But what I've written here is correct for Coulomb interacting charges.
So how can you test it?
So what one wants to do is go into this pseudo-gap region and look, especially at the spin physics. One's interested in looking at the low-energy spin physics at low temperatures in this regime. Not so much coming down above the D-wave superconducting phase boundary, but more to the left. There also, would be various implications for charge transport coming from this Wigner crystal, sure, but that we haven't worked out to such an extent. But there's certainly many specific predictions for spin.
What are qualitative predictions? How we just distinguish between one and another?
Well, for instance, in a pure system, one has this linear temperature susceptibility in here.
What
the magnetic
system. For pure system, what do you mean disorder?
That means without disorder. So with disorder, that's a whole other story, which I didn't want to bring up in this talk. And I certainly am happy to tell you we know numerous things here. There's a really interesting physics which we've been working on. I mean, Senthil here has made a lot of progress in understanding physics of a dirty D-wave superconductor as well as some of the spin physics in this region. So there's very interesting things, and for instance, the possibility of a spin metal, which acts like a diffusive metal for spin, but not for charge. There's really very incredible exotic physics going on here. The fact that when the spin charge separation and its consequences for an insulating state, I think, are extremely novel.
Well, I mean, in usual quantum magnetism, one describes spins in terms of spin operators, which are bilinear to fermions and are bosons. Here one has a phase in which there's low energy spin physics, so the spins are carried by neutral fermions.
Which is somehow intermediate between those spin models and the paramagnetism of a normal metal.
May I ask you what you think in this intermediate region? On a small space scale, it will be a real superconductivity?
No, this is a non-superconducting state.
Yes.
So the
in this case, I don't understand the situation you mentioned, that you think that it's Cooper pair, like the radiation of the Cooper pair.
Yeah, I guess in a near this phase boundary.
The most interesting the situation is if we have the, for example, real what you mentioned from the beginning, Anderson localization. It inevitably should be, but nevertheless, maybe you overcome it because you think that this phase fluctuation may be more serious.
I mean, one can imagine Anderson localization of the Cooper pairs. That's something
right,
what's
Cooper
called
pairs,
a.
Because it may be already not Cooper pairs, but maybe fermions as itself.
Well, that's different physics. So this is, again, in our assumption, motivated by all the experiments showing the pseudo gap behavior, is that the important electronic degrees of freedom are paired.
Well,
at low temperatures.
That's and immediately the question. It's a very important question from experimental point of view.
Absolutely.
On the local properties, if you are doing some correlation functions, for example, measuring something which are relevant to short range things,
yeah.
You think that you would see superconductive properties.
I think we should say pairing is a better, for instance, single particle spectral function. Should look very much like that in a superconductor.
Any other questions? Well, let's thank Liam for a beautiful.